We're all aware of Europe's debt crisis, but the economic problems of the Eurozone, well, they're only the tip of the iceberg. The crisis has deeper roots. Distant and unaccountable elites, big bureaucratic governments, runaway welfare spending programs, ageing societies. We've not even mentioned Jeremy Corbyn. He's the firebrand Labour leader who wants to move Britain to the far left. Oliver Hartwich is the executive director of the New Zealand Initiative. He's also author of a new paper called Why Europe Failed. Oliver, welcome to Between the Lines.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
A decade ago, several experts predicted that Europe would surpass the United States, run the 21st century. No one would say that today. What's happened?
Quite a few things at once. I think we first had the euro crisis, which started in 2010, when suddenly markets realized that we had quite a few heavily indebted countries on the periphery of the eurozone. And that crisis has been dragging, of course, for the past 5 years and erupted every now and then for different countries. First for Greece, of course, but then for Ireland, for Spain, for Portugal, for Cyprus, and for Greece most recently. And arguably, this crisis is not solved yet. But there are other crises, of course. Most recently, of course, the refugee crisis, and Europe is absolutely helpless in dealing with it. And underlying all of this, I think there is a crisis of competitiveness. The European economy is simply not as dynamic as other economies around the world. It's a demographic crisis where Europe is simply getting older and where countries like Italy and Germany are now recording median ages of 44, 45 years, so something unprecedented in world history. And I argue in this paper that for Europe, there is practically no way back to where it once was.
Well, let's go through some of the problems you've identified. Political integration. I mean, you say it's just been an impossible task given the overwhelming national and cultural differences within the continent. But surely this must have dawned on the architects of the European Union in the mid-1950s.
Well, I think if you're looking at political integration that started in the 1950s, there were a few motivations behind the process of political integration that are not clearly visible from today's perspective. And I think we first have to keep in mind that the whole project started as a Cold War project. It was meant to consolidate Western Europe against the threat of the Soviet Union. So it was a means to an end in that way. The other thing was, of course, that European nations try to apply the lessons from the First and the Second World War, and rather than trying to punish the losers of the war again and impose, you know, sanctions on them and shun them out of the international community, they were actually trying to basically guarantee this peace by integrating closely. So for France, for example, political integration meant that they had more control over Germany, whereas for Germany, of course, it was a re-entry ticket back into civilized society after the atrocities of the Holocaust and National Socialism.
And in fairness to the European Union, I know this goes against your thesis, but life in Europe has unquestionably improved since those days. I mean, if you go back six decades ago, before the creation of the EU, I mean, much of Berlin was a basket case. In Britain, I think food rationing had just ended. The eastern half of the continent, remember, it was dominated by thuggish, incompetent communist dictatorships. And yet, over the last, six decades now, under the EU leadership, living standards have grown dramatically, health has improved, life expectancy has increased, been no real war, no rationing, no communism. Surely that's a good thing, Oliver.
Surely. I'm not denying at all that Europe has improved somewhat. However, to be fair, there are also countries outside the EU that have improved. Think of Switzerland, think of Norway, arguably, are richer than the EU average, and they are outside the European Union. So it's been possible to actually improve. And the other thing I would say is, looking through the decades, you can see that the average growth rates for EU members has actually decreased decade by decade, whereas other parts of the world economies, notably in Asia, for example, have grown and continued expanding and improving their growth rates. So the European Union, I think, shouldn't really take too much credit for that development.
And then there's the welfare state that you document in your paper. I think you say the European Union states account for something like 7% of the world's population, yet 50-55% of spending on welfare. That's extraordinary. The counter-argument, though, would be that at least the welfare states helped bring about some political stability to Europe.
Well, it probably helped to bring about that. It probably helped lots of politicians to win elections as well. And I'm not denying that in the short term you might get some positive effects out of that. What I'm saying in the paper is that, of course, the result of all of this welfare policy over the decades has been to leave Europe heavily indebted and in a state where the state has grown so big. I mean, think of France, where the state accounts for 57% of the economy, that you cannot even finance the operations of the state anymore. So we've really spent too much, we have taxed too much, we have borrowed too much in Europe, and therefore I think this business model of the European welfare state has reached the end of its natural life.
And demographics as well. I mean, all these problems you describe, they've been exacerbated by Europe's aging society, and that may well get worse, right?
It will get worse. And as I mentioned earlier, we are already in a situation now where the median age, so basically the age that divides a society into two groups, one older, one younger than the median age, is 44, 45 years in countries such as Italy and Germany. In Australia and in New Zealand, currently it stands at around 37, 38 years. So you can see that European countries are already a lot older, and they will get older still. Think of Germany, for example. Mm-hmm. Germany's median age may well reach about 50 in the middle of the 21st century. And it's simply unprecedented. There are no other countries in world history that have ever experienced a median age above 50, perhaps with the exception of Vatican City. But we simply don't know how society will be dealing with this. Mm. And by the way, one thing to keep in mind is when a population ages as much as it does in Germany, for example, it also means that the working age population is shrinking drastically. And for Germany, this means that by 2050, Germany will lose about a third of its current working age population. Now, at some stage, you cannot make up for this demographic development with increases in productivity, though. So that means that Germany will probably enter a period in the not-too-distant future where it is facing negative trend growth rates.
Mm. And yet Europe, despite all of that, Oliver, still commands a lot of influence in the world. It accounts for three of the UN Security Council's five permanent members, Britain, France, Russia. And of course, there's the G7. You've got Britain, Germany, France, Italy, the EU. Is all that justified given everything you've just said?
Well, what I would say about that is actually these are the remnants of a past era.
Mm.
And if we constitute the Security Council today, it is very unlikely that it would be the same constitution that it has historically had.
Right.
I mean, nowadays, of course, you would include a country like India in a Security Council. So really, the way I would phrase it is that Europe is living off its substance, of everything that it had built up over centuries, but it won't be able to sustain in the future.
My guest today is Oliver Hartwich from the New Zealand Initiative, and we're talking about why Europe failed. Oliver, where to now for Europe?
Well, first of all, I think Europe has to realize that the introduction of the euro currency was a mistake, that didn't work for Europe, and is clearly visible in countries such as Greece that has actually made it practically impossible for Greece to find any positive economic growth. It has led to a massive unemployment of above 25%, massive youth unemployment of above 50% for Greece. So I think this European monetary project was a mistake, and Europe should really try to unscramble the egg, as difficult as it will be. The other thing that I would say is that Europe has to rediscover the virtues of the free market. Europe's economies have simply become too state-dominated. There are now several European countries where state spending is above 50% of GDP. Now, with that kind of economic constitution, you cannot generate growth because the state has basically crowded out private initiative and private investment. So if Europe really wants to get back onto its feet, it needs to free the market to do the job for it.
Well, on that note, has Angela Merkel's policies fared and David Cameron's fiscal agenda? I ask because it seems to me that Germany and Britain, from what I can tell, are the only two nations in the EU coping pretty well, all things considered, with the fallout from the financial crisis.
It looks quite good for both Germany and Britain from abroad. I still have my doubts about the sustainability of both their business models, because if you're looking at Germany is basically benefiting from monetary union in the short run because it gets very low interest rates. It gets the benefits of an exchange rate that doesn't reflect Germany's economic strength and competitiveness, but it reflects the weaknesses of other Eurozone members. And therefore, Germany is getting some extra help that it probably won't be able to sustain. And in the case of Britain, I think, unfortunately, there are too many things about the British economic upswing that are also not sustainable. Think of Britain's housing market. I think Britain still has a lot of work to do. And keep in mind, of course, that Britain still runs budget deficits in the order of 4% or 5% of GDP. So Britain is not out of the woods yet.
I suppose the point I was trying to make about Britain, though, is that the fiscal austerity policies implemented by the Chancellor Osborne, far from leading to doom and gloom, it's actually led to some kind of economic recovery in Britain.
Yes, and certainly that was something that the Labour Party in Britain always denied that was possible.
Indeed.
But George Osborne did exactly the right thing. He cut back spending. Actually, he should have probably cut spending a bit further. He had 5 years to bring the budget deficit from 10% of GDP in 2010 down to about 5% today. he probably could have been even stricter on austerity policies, and he's now promised to eliminate the rest of the budget deficit, these remaining 5 percentage points of GDP, until 2020. And I think he should really stick with that policy, because long run, Britain will not be able to run these budget deficits forever.
Well, that brings us to Jeremy Corbyn. He's the new leader of Britain's Labour Party, an unashamed socialist. It's quite fascinating, isn't it, Oliver? In the 1990s, we had Tony Blair. I mean, he clearly understood that after all the disasters of the 1970s, economic stagflation, high inflation, high unemployment, that Britain's Labour Party needed to make its peace with the markets and work from the centre. Corbyn, by contrast, favours higher taxes. He wants to renationalise the post office, energy production, the railways. What do you make of Corbyn?
Yeah, and he wants to open the coal mines, and he wants to really go back to the 1980s, and he probably wants to add another suicide note to the Labour Party's history. I mean, there was Michael Foot, of course.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the longest suicide note in political history.
1983, yeah.
Yes, indeed, the Labour Party manifesto back then. I think in the case of Jeremy Corbyn, I think it could be quite a short suicide note, but it will be a suicide note nevertheless.
Well, he hasn't got much support from his colleagues. But what does this mean for the Tories? Do they try to move to the centre themselves to try to win over all those disgusted centrist Labour voters? Or should the Tories still move in that free market direction?
Well, of course, I would favour free market reforms for Britain as well. But having said that, for the Tories, it doesn't really matter too much what they do, whether they move a little bit more to the right, whether they stay in the centre where they are, because Jeremy Corbyn is so far to the left that in any kind of median voter model, it is really easy for the Conservative Party to win a majority, because Corbyn has basically made himself unelectable to the British public. Yeah. He is electable, of course, to Labour supporters, but they themselves, of course, stand way to the left of the political centre.
And meanwhile, you could argue that America's Democrats, they've also made their own notable left turn. I mean, Bill Clinton's New Democrats are out now. The Democrats want a party like it's 1969. You've got this Bernie Sanders, a socialist. Hillary Clinton even, they're running to the left, even to the left of President Obama's economic issues.
And meanwhile, on the other side of politics, you have Donald Trump, and he's running to the populist right. So maybe we should actually see all of these politicians in the same light. These are not necessarily left-wing or right-wing extremists. Mm. They are all populists, and they're really riding the wave of popular disenchantment with modern politics, whether it is Sanders, whether it is Donald Trump, whether it is Jeremy Corbyn.
It makes Australia and New Zealand look very good by comparison. Oliver, thanks so much for being on RN.
Thank you, Tom.
Via Skype, that was Oliver Hartwich. He's author of a new paper called Why Europe Failed, published by the New Zealand Initiative. And we've put a link to it on our website.